Historically, at our church, and this goes back to my arrival here 28 years ago, we've always tried to do what we could to encourage those who serve our nation in the branches of its military. And we have often had these individuals, once they are deployed into harm's way, invite them to come into the pulpit and address the congregation and relate to them some of their experiences while they were in battle. There have been a long list, has been a long list of men who have accepted this invitation and have delivered very stirring comments and addresses to our congregation over the years. One of the ways that we like to draw attention to the fact that one of our members is in harm's way is that when they are deployed, we fly their branch's flag from one of our flagpoles out front. Presently, there is a Navy flag that continues to fly for Tyler Ristie. He is in and out of, he's a doer of deeds, and occasionally is doing a deed, and so we keep the Navy flag going. And we also have the Army flag, which has been posted out there since Sean was deployed to Afghanistan. He's now back, and we keep the flag flying until they are able to return to the home church and hopefully to address the congregation. Now, I'm pleased that Sean has accepted our invitation and will be giving you his experiences in just a moment. But there is one thing about Sean, and he's based over the next 2 years at Fort Lewis, Washington, and will return there after his break is over. But he brought a surprise for us when he came in today. He brought the a perfect example of feminine pulchritude, the lovely Miss Terry Harper. Terry, stand up and let the people see you, baby. Thank you. Now, Terry, I want to tell you something. One of the things we try to recognize and seek to do so is that our nation takes young men and women now, puts them in harm's way, and leaves the spouse behind. And it's very trying, especially on those occasions when there are children involved. And so usually it's the mother that has to take care of all of the household goings-on, manage children, make sure they're taken care of, and so on. We also want to salute you as a potential, and I say potential because she has at least for the moment agreed to marry Sean. And you have options. You can still get out of this. But if you go through with it, you will become a military wife. And they're extremely important people for our servicemen and women, the husbands when they're in that condition and situation. So we salute you for the job that you're about to take on, and we thank you for your upcoming service to the country. By the way, she is a Limey. She's from Peterborough, Ontario. May I pardon?
Canuck.
Hullabadoo Canuck Canuck, is that what you're saying here?
She's from Canada. A Canuck.
Oh, a Canuck. Huh. There's a hockey team that calls himself Canucks. I've never known what that was, what a Canuck was. Do you claim to be a Canuck? What are you then? What is
it? It's just a Canadian short for Canadian.
It is. Well, they're the Montreal Canadiens. And then there are the Canucks, and all of them claim to be from Canada.
Yeah.
Oh, the French. Well, they do get involved, don't they? That explains everything. I am pleased to present to you this congregation a member of this church since he was a little boy, and we're so proud to have him back and in good health. Please welcome to St. Charles, Missouri, and back to Grace Doctrine Church, private first class Sean Woodjahusky. Sean, thank you for coming, brother. We're going to have to open the doors, boys, because he doesn't have a mic. Put this in your pocket. We can do this. I've done this before. steel hook. It'll be a lot easier.
Thank you.
If you would do this, if you would take that and hook it.
All right. Okay. All
right. Push this button to the right.
Oh, yeah.
And then to the left. Back up on you. Got it?
Perfect. Okay. All right. All right. First and foremost, I want to thank Grace Doctrine Church, everyone, for the prayers and provisions that we received while we were in Afghanistan. That was by far the best thing that we could ask for, especially the prayers. I'm going to talk a little bit about where we were in Afghanistan, the dangers of the area, and if you really understand how dangerous it was and how few casualties we actually took, considering where we were at, it was pretty amazing. The first picture, this is us at the German airport. This is us en route. This is about December 17th. Of 2011, and we had no expectations. We really didn't know where we were going in Afghanistan at this time. We only knew Zahari District. We didn't know what that meant, but that was in the Kandahar province, and the Zahari District had been the Taliban, where the Taliban was actually formed, and for many years we had conducted no operations in the Zahari District. And this was NATO forces in general, not just U.S. forces. So for all intents and purposes, when they said, you know, there was nothing going on in Afghanistan all through the 2000s, they weren't exactly being truthful to you. Basically what happened was the NATO forces were pushed out of Zahari all the way up until about 2009 when the United States first started to conduct operations within Zahari. And the operations were initially very brutal. It was the 101st that initially broke into the Zahari district of Afghanistan, and they took heavy casualties, and that was followed up by the 1st Infantry Division, and then we followed the 1st Infantry Division as the 3rd unit to take Zahari district. So this was a small village, and most of what our operation was in Zahari was we were supposed to provide morale and welfare to, you know, the people of Zahari and in this particular case, the village of Anazai. But oftentimes, what it is they just flip flop between U.S. and Afghani Taliban forces. So they'll be with you until you leave, and then when the Taliban comes in, they'll be supporting the Taliban. It's an unwinnable fight in a lot of ways. But we spent a lot of the U.S. taxpayers' money on on things such as this school. The engineers come in. We provide security while they build things like this school. And you can see it. It's a pretty large compound. And it's funny because I'm pretty sure they teach you how to be a better terrorist at schools like these. But, you know, it's our mission, and we do it. And we don't complain about it. But it was really interesting. This is actually, you can see this is Cop Colk right here. This is the HLZ at our small COP. We had about 120 people or so roughly on our COP. And you can see right there is that's what an average guard tower looks like. We had five of those on our COP. And generally you have two machine gun positions in those towers. And in this HLZ, you can see, I don't know if you can see, but we got like Constantine wire running out here so nobody can hop the walls on you. But this was really interesting. This is when we first got into Afghanistan. We didn't have anything, hardly. We had a few computers and a few phones. So the Green Berets found out about how in dire condition our COP was, and they flew in a helicopter and they dropped us off a TV and some other games and some stuff like that. And, you know, they just rolled right out of, I got this on picture. It was really cool just to see the Special Forces even helping these guys out, you know. So it was really nice. And then, you know, you didn't actually know when your next meal was going to be. It's kind of funny, but it's true, you know. You know, missions, oftentimes take precedence over sleep or food. So when you did get a meal, like you ate it as quick as you could. Interesting enough, this is a PFC Bonnie. He was in my section. He was infantry. Even though we were a cav unit, we used a lot of infantry. He's actually from St. Charles, Missouri himself. So we actually had two people in the platoon from St. Louis, which is kind of rare. And then this is the vehicles we first used. These are called MRAPs. This is the back view of an MRAP right here. And this is Flores right here. He was the driver of the MRAP. Generally, then you have a sergeant, E5 or E6, who is the truck commander. And then you have a gunner. That was PFC Fry. And then you have a section medic as well. And that was me, being the section medic for the MRAP crew. All right. To give you an idea, the MRAPs, they don't go out by themselves. You have a mine roller because they put so many mines in the ground, even like four vehicles. It is the lead truck, and then you have another three trucks that usually follow behind it. You usually have four trucks in a group. The weapon systems on the truck can vary from like a 240 Bravo, which is a medium to light machine gun, but generally use a 50 caliber or a Mark 19, which is a grenade launcher, and that gets pretty fun. But this is what a typical Afghan village looks like. It's not really much to look at. It's hard to believe that people actually can live and sustain themselves in these areas. I mean, there's nothing out there, and they do. I have no idea how they do it. But this is their grape growers. This is what they're trying to push the Afghans into, as opposed to poppies or marijuana, but they're quite unsuccessful. But the grape rows are, you'll see that they get a lot greener, but in January, it's just dead. Everything is dead there. It's bleak, it's barren, it's almost depressing, you know, to wake up and see, you know, nothing but gray and brown, nothing is living. But then when I came back from leave, everything was green, and I had no idea where all this came from. These are actually the same grape rows that you see in the previous picture. You can see how green they are, how lush they look. And then that strip of pink that you see above the grape rows, that's the poppy fields. And they tell you that we're burning the poppies and that we're taking care of the poppies. Out of the hundreds of poppy fields that we've seen in the Zahari district, I've seen one that was burned out of the hundreds. And they range in size. They can be acres to somebody's backdoor poppy plants. So they are still in existence, and they are abundant in Afghanistan. So this was at the start of our 60-day mission out there in Afghanistan. We had a small village to the south, which was called Pankila. It was a Taliban stronghold. It was almost like a crossroads-type village. And they got the idea in their head that they are going to send us out there for 60 days on 12 to 20-day rotations. Our platoon was the only platoon out there. We didn't share this place with anybody else. It was just us. And we were looking pretty grizzled at the end of this. You can tell that a couple of these guys, they haven't been able to shave because we didn't have water. And the water we did have, we saved for drinking because you didn't know when the next resupply was going to come. We dealt with whatever challenges we had, and we completed our mission. And this is an example of what a mission in July would look like in Afghanistan. It's extremely hot. Even in the morning, you're looking at probably about 90 to 95 degrees at this time. And there's huge, these guys have huge rucksacks on. You know, we're talking 80, 90 pounds on your back in addition to whatever other equipment that you're carrying just on your chest or on your front load. So me being a medic with my aid bag and my equipment, the heat, actually, I was down to 140 pounds, but if I stepped on a scale, I was at 220, so almost half my weight was just in equipment that I carried and rucked around through Afghanistan. And this is Corey Garman, and this is the soldier that you all prayed very prayed for. And this is him pulling guard on that same three-day mission. This is on that final morning. And he was wounded a few days after this picture was taken. He stepped on a pressure plate IED, and he lost his left leg just below the ankle, or just above the ankle, excuse me. His right leg was an open compound fracture. And it's very trying to see that and to want to help your friend and know that he's in extreme pain and things that they're saying, but he is a strong individual in himself, that he was able to keep himself really out of shock. He did more than I did to maintain his own and preserve his own life. And this is the 60-day mission. This is where we were sleeping for those 60 days. You can see we have cots in the upper right corner and just a tarp. Thankfully, it didn't rain, or that would have been pretty rough. But some of us, there were these little rooms right here, and some of us slept in there. But we actually had a Chinook drop at one point to resupply us because they couldn't get to us. And we used the net from the cargo to make our own little volleyball court right there. So we played volleyball right there in Afghanistan. It was really, really quite interesting. And we had a marijuana field right outside of our compound. I kid you not, it was like right around the corner. You didn't really need to wear anything to even get to it. And our latrines were right next to it. And this is my good friend Nicholas Neely. And he decided he was going to put a bunch of leaves up and camouflage himself into the field. But a lot of guys had fun with it, you know. And there's Justin Zupan. He was another infantryman, just hanging out in the field with we had a shotgun that we kept on site. And this is Neely testing out his camouflage. So. And I do have more pictures of videos of some of the explosions that we did out there, but I'm not allowed to show those, so at least not in a public type setting, unfortunately, because they are pretty interesting to actually see some of those explosions, to see just how much HME we find and dig up. HME being homemade explosives. A lot of times it's like ammonium nitrate. And if people ask me, you know, like, is ammonium nitrate really that volatile? And I said, well, consider that ammonium nitrate was the primary explosive that Timothy McVeigh used in Oklahoma. It gives you an idea of what they're using there for explosives. And so this was here was a, after about 8 months of being in Zahari, My company took about 3 casualties. It was actually a cap troop, but we were called a company. We took about 3 casualties out of about 120 people. And the 3 casualties, when I refer to casualty, I'm talking about guys that had to be evac from theater and they could not return to duty. And considering that we were in just as a dangerous area as anyone else, the other companies had 20 to 40 per company at this time. Alpha, Charlie, and Delta had all 20 to 40, and they were no longer combat effective, so they had to move us, and we moved to a village on the Paki border to do basically border patrol for the rest of our time in Afghanistan. This is around August that they moved us, and believe it or not, that is the nicest village we've seen in Afghanistan in our entire time there, and that I would never want to live there. And oftentimes, your leaders will sit down, your platoon leader, your captain will sit down, and he will want to talk with the local villagers, and they will drink chai. That is what they do. And you pull security. Thankfully, believe it or not, there is no fight on the border. You would think that the border would be where we were trying to stop these guys from infiltrating into the country, but the border had literally nothing going on. There was no fight. There was no threat of attack. We never seen contact at all, not even a single firefight, which we were hardened. We were trained for it. When we first got into Painkilla, literally, it was May 16th, and we got into 6 firefights in that same day. the same day, we had to try to infiltrate that village. And the firefights would last anywhere from 20 minutes to about 40 minutes. And, you know, so it was basically a whole day of fighting for this village. And once we fought, and once we actually pushed out the Taliban, then we could actually set up operations there. But we were well trained in how to deal with the Taliban and firefighting. So, but a lot of times on patrols, you see you'll come across things that aren't just the Taliban in that particular area that's dangerous. There was a patrol in the spring, and we were walking through a poppy field, and I was on point, actually, which means I was the front man, and I was the front man for the second squad that was moving through a particular area, and a saw-scaled viper, which is the most deadly snake in Afghanistan, happened to cross about 5 feet in front of my path, and it turned at me, and it didn't know it at the time, but it was a highly aggressive snake, and it started to hiss and saw its scales at me, and that was terrifying. It was almost more terrifying than the the Taliban. And I stopped, and my team leader had come up to me, and he's like, "What are you doing?" And then he seen the snake, and he cursed and charged his rifle at the snake. And I was not thrilled. I'm, "What are you doing?" So, but there are other threats out there than just Taliban. There's scorpions. We were living with the scorpions at Pankilla. They would come out at night. They would just litter the walls. And they would be crawling all underneath your cots, and you knew they were there, and there would be these small clear ones, and they tell you those are the ones you got to look out for, and that's all the only ones we've seen. So go figure. But you know, the area, you know, all kinds of threats, you know, whether it be Taliban. A lot of times also your leadership left you hang out and dry and left a lot to be desired. And I tell this story because it's true and because I think people need to know that the day Corey Garmon got hit, that should have never happened, the day he was wounded. We were sent out on a patrol, and we were the first platoon being the red platoon, and our third platoon was blue platoon. Blue platoon had a mission earlier in that day to go through a village and basically scout out a village. And it was a village like Pankilla, where it was a crossroads type village that we knew the Taliban were running supplies through. And they got hit earlier in the day, and they got hit with a IED strike, and a couple of their guys took shrapnel. And basically our mission was, we were just like a basically almost like a ready five. And we mounted up, and we hiked out there to where they were at. And we only had nine guys. Nine guys, that's it. That's not very many. So it's basically an escort for them out. And we had four Afghan National Army with us and one interpreter. So we had 14 guys total. One of them didn't even have a weapon. And we got Blue Platoon out of there, and we gave them all of our water. This is in July. This is in about 3 o'clock in the afternoon that we got them out, and we gave up our water. And it's about 115 degrees right now at this time. And we get a call, and the 82nd Airborne is currently the head of the operation at this time in Afghanistan. And they tell us to, with nine guys and four ANA, to clear an entire village. And this is a very big village. Clearing villages is a company-sized element. That is what a company should do. It is not designed for platoons, and specifically not sections. And we were told to clear this village. We told them we had no water, that we had only nine soldiers, and they told us to push forth. Granted, if you were told to do something, you do it regardless. You can make an argument that it's not wise, but if they continue to push it on you, you do your mission. So we did our mission. But we lost a soldier because of it, you know, and how they went through. And we could have lost a lot more, because when Garmin got hit, they ambushed us within minutes after that. And if it was, thankfully, because of our light machine gunner, who his name was Tony Lichty, that he was able to suppress the fire long enough for us to move Corey Garmin and get to an HLZ. But if they had maneuvered on us, when the IED went off, we had three soldiers who had severe TBI, two of them had shrapnel wounds, including Corey Garmin. So that was more than half of our section was down, and the ANA were hiding at this time. So we had four guys, basically, who were healthy enough to actually move. And those are some of the decisions that were made over there that cost soldiers their lives or their limbs. You know, if it had been done right, I don't think we would have lost anyone. But you're given the mission that you're given. You don't argue with it. You take it. And you complete it. You really learn to appreciate things once you're over there. Running water, toilets. I mean, literally, you get tired of a port-a-john. a good square meal and sleep, just the small things in life that you kind of take it for granted every day. And when you don't have them, that's when you realize, you know, that you have to appreciate those things. And, you know, you learn to appreciate it a lot more when you get back. But at this time, I'd like to open up for any questions, if anyone has anything they want to ask.
Hey, Sean, why would anybody in their right mind have a medic appointment?
That's a good question. It's he was a junior team leader. They just threw him in that role. Our team leader was actually only a specialist. And for whatever reason, because it was only four of us out there. It was me, him. There's a guy named Benjamin Cubitt. He was on the 240. He was carrying around a huge heavy machine gun, so I can understand that. And then there was a guy named Daniel Wagner. Daniel Wagner had a few screws loose. He wasn't all there. And, you know, he's not going to put himself on point. And Wagner's sure not going to be on point. So he can't put the machine gunner on point. So I ended up on point. But, yeah. I had a M4 with a pistol grip on it, so it had a kind of easy up action. And then I had a 60, which is like a red dot sight, a 68 sight on it. And interesting enough, me and my best friend Nicholas Neely, who you've seen with all the marijuana camouflage, he was my me and him were for a lot of patrols over there. We were partners on patrols, and he carried a M14 long rifle with a 10x scope. And oftentimes what we did on patrols is that I would take the short distances. If there was anything like corners, doorways, or anything like that needed to be covered, I would take it, and then he would go ahead and cover me on the long range, you know. And it's kind of interesting, like it's how life works too, you know. God will always pair you up with someone who can take what you're lacking, and you can provide them with the cover that they're lacking, and it works well that way. So, any other questions? Yep.
So, did you guys operate within the cover of artillery when you
went out? We were not authorized to use artillery out there at any point in which I was out there. In fact, we didn't get clearance for mortars, let alone artillery, until our mission was almost done at that time. So, and even, and I can understand the reasoning where they say that a lot of times they don't want the villagers to be bystanders to artillery or mortar strikes. But at the same time, the villagers are allowing themselves to be within the Taliban's grasp. There was nothing stopping these villagers, and that's what people need to understand. There's nothing stopping these villagers from coming up to us and telling us, hey, the Taliban are coming and using my house. They willingly allow the Taliban into their villages, into their homes, and then they cry wolf, you know, when we're there and say, oh, we're being pressured and pushed around. And really, it's the other way around. They allow them to happen, and then they cry about it later when we're there. So, if you understand their mentality, how those people work, then you'll understand the Taliban, or you'll understand just how almost evil that society is. Another interesting fact is that a lot of times we'd have to do long joint patrols, not just with the ANA, but with the ALP, which is the Afghan local police. And these guys receive about 2 weeks of training and about a 30-second background check, and then they're handed a AK-47 assault rifle, and then they're told to just, you know, run missions with us. Well, I know a lot of you guys have probably heard about the green-on-blues that have occurred over the last 6 to 8 months over there, where Afghan soldiers are killing U.S. soldiers. A lot of those aren't the Afghan National Army. A lot of those are the ALP because they receive no training or background check. A lot of times they find out that the Taliban do join the ALP, and just for that reason, just to, because they know they can infiltrate easier that way and find you in a compromising position. But the ALP oftentimes are basically the scum of the earth. They're the people who do not want to work because they know the ALP is pretty much the laziest job and you get the most money from the local and provincial governments. And when we did have to work with them, we would go and this is pretty rough to talk about, but we would go and we would secure like a strong point for the night, and they would go into the village and secure themselves, young boys, for the night. And that's part of their culture. That's accepted. So.
John, people that preceded you in that pulpit that have been in Afghanistan and Iraq speak of the difficult, I've lost the term, rules of engagement.
Oh.
Do you find that to be significant?
I did, Joe. The rules of engagement are very hindering over there. Unless you can know where direct fire is coming from to a degree and not be able to return fire unless you have eyes on the enemy. But a lot of times if somebody's in cover or if they're hiding, you're not going to see them. So what happens is your rules of engagement often hinder you. I was fortunate enough to be in a platoon that didn't ignore the rules of engagement, but didn't pay attention to them either. And a lot of times we were fired upon, especially in the day that we received the 6 firefights. We actually had a sniper who was firing upon us, and we weren't sure where he was at, but we had a general direction. And we shot over 50 40-millimeter grenades in his general direction. Because the idea is, if you lose a guy because you didn't return fire, then that is unacceptable and inexcusable to my platoon's chain of command. And that saved a lot of us over there. And we didn't realize how fortunate and blessed we were until we left and the new unit took over for us. We were replaced by the 117th Infantry Battalion, who is also part of the 2nd Infantry Division. And they replaced us in the Zahari District at Kop Kolk and at Pankhila. And within 2 weeks, they had lost their platoon sergeant, 2 first sergeants, as well as many other soldiers. So they took more casualties than we took in 8 months, in a matter of 2 weeks. And that's how blessed we were, how fortunate we were. To be as successful as we were.
You were in a circumstance where this fellow you mentioned earlier lost his foot.
Yes.
I understand from your dad that you suffered a concussion.
I did. I was blown back. I was only about maybe 10 to 15 feet away from him at the time the IED went off. And if you can imagine, like a lot of the villages, they'll have a roadway, but they'll have a river that they call a wadi, like a small stream almost, that runs in between their roads, so you have 2 paths on either side. And the IED was placed at a bridge on a bridge over the wadi between the 2 sides of the path. It was placed on one end of the bridge, and I was just off the other end of the bridge. So, and when the explosion goes off, you're not really aware of what happens. You find yourself on the ground, and then you get up, and you want to see, and you're actually batting at the air, and because you're hoping that, you know, you can clear a path of vision, but there's so much dust kicked up that you can't see anything and you can't hear anything, because you get the swan song in your ear, then that's all you can hear, and you're trying to get focus, and when you can finally hear again, that's when you hear the screaming and the yelling, and that's when you know you have to go. But it's unfortunate that happened, and I'm happy that I was able to perform my job, that I didn't freeze, because you never know how you're going to react in that particular situation, and I credit the Lord for giving me the strength to battle through a lot of that, and as long as, and not just that, but even the parts after that, because it does affect your psyche for a long time to and to continue to ask God, you know, for the strength to move past that and to be able to move past that, you know, it's really good. And it's been successful for me.
Jim. In your particular unit, do you have any other fellow believers that you guys could pray together?
We did pray. A lot of times it was more individual. We ended up getting a sergeant towards the end of the tour who was very much a Christian, and he prayed with us and led prayers, and that was good to have, because I know a lot of guys needed it, and you get so run down, and unfortunately a lot of the times you're praying on the go, because a lot of your missions weren't even planned. It's, you know, something happened, you have to be, you know, ready on a moment's notice, and, you know, but. Yeah.
After you guys kind of like cleared the villages or whatever, were you guys specifically told by
them? No, we just never been given a directive one way or the other. We're not supposed to burn them unless given like an order or a mission directive to do that. And as far as I know, I'd never seen U.S. soldiers actually go and burn a poppy field. I had seen the Afghan army attempt once to burn a single field. Interesting enough, the day they were told to go and burn the field, it was raining. So, take it for what it's worth, I guess. But, Ms. Susan.
Explain to you a little bit more about some of the rules of engagement, what specifically some of them are.
The rules of engagement where you... cannot fire it unless fired upon first. You can actually sit there and see somebody almost in act that would look sinister, like where he's looks like he's planting an IED or running wires to or from an IED, and you cannot fire upon them. And I had a couple friends who were in a guard tower. This was Bonnie and Neely, and they found a guy planting an IED in the ground. And they had to get clearance all the way up to a brigade level to fire on this guy. And by the time they got clearance to fire on him, he was already gone. It only takes about 8 minutes to effectively plant an IED in the ground, dig the hole, place the charge, the pressure plate, the explosive, and they're gone. 8 minutes. You don't have time to call up to a brigade level to get clearance. So that's one way that rules of engagement actually... really hurt us over there. Another way is, just being fired upon. I know that I said that, you know, we bent the rules of engagement, but a lot of platoons didn't, and they would sit there and they would take the fire that was coming at them, and they would not fire back. And the leadership, I forgot what name they called it, but I would not want to be in those platoons just taking fire. Fire discipline or something like that, or fire superiority discipline or whatever they called that. I I don't understand it. But a lot of platoons, they were frustrated. The soldiers were frustrated that they couldn't fire their weapons back, that they couldn't defend themselves. Oh yeah, the local police department will take pop shots at our compound every now and then, and they're just down the road from us, and we can't fire back. However, the Afghan army can, so they would get up on the roof and fire back at the local police for us. But the fact that we would sit there and take fire occasionally from people who are supposed to be our allies over there, that's frustrating in itself. And a lot of times, despite your intel or whatever, you can't do what you want to do, and people walk freely wherever, even if that means coming into your compounds that you've secured. A good example of that, when we moved towards the end of the tour and we were out at that small kapa, it was called Lakaray on the Pakistan border, there was a villager who was wanted for questioning. He was a known Taliban guy, and he walked freely into our compound. We could not arrest him because we didn't have clearance to arrest him. And so he walked freely around our compound for hours before leaving, and we didn't get clearance to arrest him until the next day. They have a route clearance that generally goes through on the roads most of the time, especially the major roads. They'll go through at least probably every road at least once a day on like a, almost a set schedule. And they'll have specific equipment like X-ray machines, GPR, ground penetrating radar, stuff like that, in which they can find an IED without actually setting it off. But sometimes you'll see them roll through with the intention of just running into something, big mine rollers on their vehicles. But when we hit an IED, it's usually by accident and it's not intentional. And, that was, at the very end of the tour, we lost a sergeant because he was driving a Striker and, they had put, a IED into the ground and put a Russian landmine on top of it. And, what the landmine does is it creates a flashpoint for the IED. So it gets super hot and creates like a huge flame. And when they hit the IED, the flame jumped up and it basically fried every electrical system in the Striker, all the fail safes, the fire extinguisher systems, all that stuff. And then it caught the 50 cal on fire, and the 50 caliber started cooking off rounds, and then the engine caught on fire, and the impact from the IED alone broke his femur in his arm, and he wasn't able to escape the Striker until much later. By that time, he was already on his way out by the time they could get him out of the Striker. But it was that was the only soldier that we lost in our entire time over there, and we were very fortunate to only have one KIA for a company our size and where we were at and what we were doing. So,
yeah.
No, not my cot. I did have a friend though who had a very close encounter with a scorpion, and I watched him panic and squirm around, and it was quite interesting. He found it in his boot in the morning, and he panicked and jumped up and down, and he didn't even get stung. So I was lucky in that aspect, I suppose. Okay. Yes.
If somebody asked you why there's a lot of press about suicides in the army now more than there used to be, what would you say to them?
Well, it's interesting, and it's kind of a misnomer, because there's more suicides in the Army, but if you look at it, I believe the suicide rate is still less than the American population outside of the military. It's actually still lower. So the fact that it's still lower, it's a good thing, but I do see it increasing, and it didn't happen in our company, thankfully, as far as I know, our battalion as well. But I had heard of several soldiers killing themselves over there, and I don't know why they do it, to be honest with you. I found that if you wanted or needed help or support, it was there for you, and that was anything from, you know, mental behavioral health to even a chaplain, military chaplain. They would more than happily come out and see you, and if you really needed help bad enough, they would actually evac you from theater. So I'm not sure why the suicide rate is actually increasing, especially in theater. It boggles my mind, actually. So, yep. It's an interesting question. It's the only way I can lend encouragement is that it's like the mission that Garmin got hit on. You know, it's not the mission you want, but it's the mission you get, and you have to support the mission, whether or not you know the mission is messed up or not, and you know, if the mission goes south, you know where it went south at. It went south before it even started. And that's how you, that's how we dealt with that, you know. It was, you do your mission and you accept it.
You answered the question.
All right. Thank you.
Sean, you going to back to Fort Lewis?
I am. I leave for Fort. What's that? At Fort Lewis, I'm basically going to be, I'm no longer going to be like what I am, I don't think anyway. It'll be more training, sick call. A lot of times, if people come in the morning and they're not feeling well, by not feeling well, I mean they don't feel like doing morning PT, don't feel like running for the day. They come and see the medic, and the medic's like, yeah, okay, I'll give you some aspirin, and you can go home till lunch or whatever, you know. And it happens quite a bit. But on the bright side, I'm not getting shot at, so it won't be nearly exciting. I'm sure the next 2 years are going to drag by, but at the same time, you know, I appreciate the experience that I did get, because I do think I think anybody that goes over there with an open mind will come back a stronger person. I don't see how you couldn't come back a stronger person and more appreciative of everything in this world, big and small. So.
Thanks, y'all. Thanks for coming to see
me. All right. Thank you.
Yeah, please be seated. Let me get my gizmo back on. Oh, shoot. There we go. Never works until the glasses go. Sean, you're in a long list of fellows that have gone into harm's way since I've been here for 28 years. And each one of them has come back and addressed this congregation and told some of their experiences. And yours has been among a number of fellows that have seen the horror of war. Point is, though, is that we are a client nation yet still. And we call upon our youth. How old are you, Sean?
25.
25 years old. I remember when I turned 25, Sean. A few things I remember today, but I remember that. And I remember thinking, a quarter of a century old, I'm dang near dead. But our nation calls young fellows such as yourself to duty, puts them in harm's way. And we back home are reduced to utilizing the only artillery we have, and that is prayer. And, of course, you've been on our military prayer list since you joined the Army. And we do pray for you and for others who are deployed as well as all who are serving. And it is a great honor for this congregation to have had so many young men and even some women serve in our military. And a number of them have been placed in harm's way. And the KIA that you told us about is the first, I believe, that any of our men who have been deployed in Iraq or Afghanistan has suffered. And there have been hundreds of fellows who have been in platoons and divisions with people from GDC. We've been told in the past that a prayer barrage is very effective in protecting people who are deployed in harm's way. The Lord will take care of those who are His. And there's blessing by association from them down to others who serve with them. We are therefore honored once again to have had you come to our congregation, and we most definitely thank you for your service to the country. Thanks for being with us. Don't go. Every time someone is deployed, we raise their branch flag out front. And when you were deployed, we put the Army flag up. And Gary Watson, who is in charge of flag deployment, struck the Army flag this morning. He put it in this nice little holder here for you. And this flag has flown since you left to go to Afghanistan, and we just took it down this morning. And this is our recognition of your service to the country and your safe return to Grace Doctrine Church, your family, and to Missouri. Thank you again for your service, Sean. We are about to break. We're going to go next door here, and there's a full meal awaiting you. You're all invited to stay. The ladies have prepared a full meal for you, and this is therefore your noon meal. You'll have time to talk with Sean and his family, as well as his fiancée, Terry. We will dismiss with a word of prayer, so shall we pray. Father, we are indeed grateful to you for the freedom we enjoy in this country. That freedom is preserved by our Lord Jesus Christ, who is the Lord of the armies. And he protects those who are his. And we thank you for the fact that Sean Wojciechowski has been returned safely to client nation America and to his home church here in Missouri. We pray for him, his family, his fiancée, and for his future service in the United States Army. We thank you for the blessings and the grace that you provide upon this church. And we thank you for the food you have provided in grace that we're about to consume. We pray you would sanctify it for us. And we lift all these prayers in the name of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen. You're dismissed.